Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tony Van Pelt, president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, who assesses the fight ahead after the Republican Senate succeeded in confirming President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. Jennifer Podkol, policy director with Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND, who talks about her group's role in providing pro bono lawyers for immigrant children being held in the U.S. and facing deportation proceedings. And Laura Huizar, staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project, who discusses Fight for 15 workers' strikes and protests in 7 states across the U.S., demanding a living wage and union representation. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The U.S. Navy is planning to hold controversial military exercises in the disputed South China Sea and Taiwan Strait in coming weeks. News of the planned exercises was leaked to the media only days after a near collision between the USS Decatur and a Chinese destroyer near the Spratly Islands, an area contested by China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. The dangerous confrontation in the South China Sea comes as U.S.-China relations have deteriorated after the Trump administration imposed $200 billion in new tariffs against Chinese exports to the U.S., and Beijing's objections to the U.S. Navy's so-called freedom of navigation military maneuvers. The South China Sea is a major international shipping channel and potential source of natural resources over which China has claimed sovereignty since the 1940s. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis canceled a visit to Beijing for security talks that had been scheduled for late October. At the same time, China canceled permission for the USS Wasp, a U.S. assault ship, to visit the port of Hong Kong. The expansion of U.S. naval exercises into the Taiwan Strait is perceived by regional observers as a major escalation of tensions between the two nations, reports the South China Morning Post. Vice President Mike Pence, in a speech before the right-wing Hudson Institute, complained of reckless harassment by the Chinese military in the South China Sea. Su Hao, a professor at China Foreign Affairs University in Beijing, observed that the South China Sea has now become an arena for U.S. and China confrontation rather than simply a territory disputed by Beijing and other regional claimants. In response to growing criticism of the company's low wages, Amazon is raising its minimum wage to $15 an hour for 350,000 warehouse and seasonal workers in the U.S. and Britain. This comes as other big box retailers like Target and Costco also pledge to raise wages for their employees to $15 an hour. The current federal minimum remains stagnant at $7.25 an hour. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, a vocal critic of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, praised the move to increase wages. Bezos, who is worth $165 billion, has become a powerful symbol of economic inequality in the U.S. Sanders told the New York Times it was indefensible for Amazon to pay low wages to hourly workers who rely on benefits from taxpayer-funded anti-poverty programs to survive. Up until the wage hike, the average Amazon worker made $29,000 a year. Many economic analysts say raising wages will not hurt Amazon's bottom line, and the company has run into trouble recruiting warehouse workers at its current low-wage rate. Across the globe, Amazon employs nearly 600,000 workers, but the retail giant is increasingly using robots in its warehouses and setting up stores without cashiers. California is now entering a new era of law enforcement accountability. Governor Jerry Brown has recently signed 2 laws giving the public access to internal police investigations and releasing body cam videos promptly after police shootings. The new laws scale back what many critics viewed as unfair protections for police officers that were adopted at the behest of police unions in the late 1970s. The availability of these records will now allow the public to hold California police departments and elected officials accountable in ways not possible before, said Peter Biebring, director of police practices at the American Civil Liberties Union of California, which was a principal supporter of both bills. A recent Los Angeles Times investigation into secrecy surrounding law enforcement discipline found that past misconduct by police witnesses, whether alleged or proven, was routinely kept hidden in court as part of California's confidentiality regulations. The new law now opens up interview transcripts, evidence, and full investigatory reports to the public, prosecutors, and defense attorneys alike. Public anger drove this year's reform efforts after the police shooting of Stephen Clark, an unarmed black man in Sacramento. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Despite several accusations of sexual misconduct, including the credible testimony of Christine Blasey Ford charging Brett Kavanaugh with attempted rape, multiple instances of false statements made under oath, and what many saw as a sham FBI investigation, President Trump's Supreme Court nominee was confirmed in the U.S. Senate by a vote of 50-48. The confirmation hearings and vote were held as thousands of activists descended on the U.S. Capitol to pressure senators to block Kavanaugh's confirmation. The loss of that fight fueled outrage against Republicans, who were seen as dismissing Christine Ford's charge of sexual assault, and worse, President Trump's mocking of her testimony at a recent campaign rally. Now the protesters, who were branded by GOP lawmakers as unruly mobs, and millions of their supporters, are focusing on the battles ahead in the conservative majority Supreme Court over the future of legal abortion, civil rights, LGBTQ rights, labor law, voter suppression, and health care. Your reporter spoke with Tony Van Pelt, president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, who talks about what she views as the deeply flawed confirmation process and the struggles ahead over the legitimacy of future Supreme Court rulings.
Well, I think that the thing that really strikes me now is the absolute glee and greed of those that are in power, these old white men, Republicans, and the women that enable them. It's pretty shocking that this could be happening in our democracy today. I think that it's really important that with the Me Too movement, Time's Up, Enough is Enough, that women are finding their voices and they are finally speaking out. And I think just taking tactics from their playbook, when women get angry, women aren't allowed to get angry. If we get angry, then we're called shrill, and now apparently we're called a mob. So they keep saying that they're talking about the Democrats, but they're not talking about the Democrats. They're talking about over 51% of the population of this country, and that is the women of this country who have had enough. And it really doesn't matter what they call us. We're not stopping.
In response to Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony that she was 100% sure Brett Kavanaugh was the one who sexually assaulted her when she was in high school, what's the message the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate is sending to women across America?
Well, I think that they've just reinforced the message. This is the way that women have been treated for millennia. It's the way that we're treated in this country. It's the way we're treated around the world. And it's men protecting men. It's men protecting themselves and protecting their power. It's the culture of sexual assault, of violence. That's the culture that we live in, the culture of women hating. And but I don't think it's going to work this time. I really don't. I think too many women have spoken out. Too many women are on the line. I mean, I was up on the Hill all last week. And even the day of, women were flying in. One of our interns flew in with a group from her school, University of Iowa, to testify. The people were holding a filibuster on the Capitol grounds that went on for over 24 hours. We're not going to stop. We're going to take back our legislatures across this country and we're going to win in 2018. And the anger is not going to go away. And no matter how gleeful they are the mob. They act like the mob. They actually act like the mafia. They're tyrants, and we're not going to put up with it any longer. We're going to put women in power into these seats, even though they've gerrymandered them. And we're going to keep on keeping until we take this country back. What we're seeing going on now is really more than just about women and sexual assault and sexual harassment. This is a backlash against our first black president. So this is not just about women. This is about racism. And we have to be honest about that. They may not be saying that right now, but that's a big piece of this, is the racism, the white supremacy. That's also going on, the hatred in this country. These people that are in power right now are very, very ugly people.
Now, impeaching Kavanaugh as one of the options here, if the Democrats take control of the House of Representatives, a lot of analysts say, hey, that's a long shot, because an impeachment process can be started, but they need two-thirds of the senators to actually boot him out of the Supreme Court. So short of that, you think just the process itself is worth investing politically into?
I do. I think that it is really a good, you know, people that are liberal that wake up in the morning and they want fairness for all believe that this process was rotten from the start. And I think that we have to talk impeachment. I think that we have to use every single avenue and not say, okay, well, there's no way that we can get two-thirds of the senators, so therefore we shouldn't try. No. We have to keep pushing forward. We can't just decide that something has already been decided before it's even been determined. We have to keep our voices strong and loud. We have to let them know we're not going to go away. They're not going to get away with this. We are taking steps to stop them.
With a 5-4 conservative majority now established on the U.S. Supreme Court, what are some of your biggest concerns about Supreme Court rulings going forward? And of course, there's a lot of concern out there about reproductive rights, labor rights, environmental regulation and climate regulation, the deregulation of Wall Street, social safety net programs, overturning criminal justice reforms, civil rights, voting rights, LGBTQ rights. The list goes on and on.
Yeah, it does. They want to rewrite America. They want to drag us back to the bad old days, and who knows what's going to happen with that. They're also filling up not just the Supreme Court, but the other federal benches and the other courts where they are allowed to appoint. That's why it's so important that we get to the polls, that we vote them out of office, that we give the Democrats a majority in both the House and the Senate, and now is going to be working to put more women into office and to do just that. That's the most important thing we can do right now. We can get people to register to vote, we can help people get to the polls, and we can all vote them out of office.
That was Toni Van Pelt, president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. Learn more about what NOW and other groups across the country are doing to protect hard-won legal and legislative victories from being overturned by the new conservative Supreme Court majority by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thousands of unaccompanied immigrant children are being held in detention by the U.S. government, with many being transferred to a refugee tent camp in the middle of the Texas desert. Many of these children are eligible for relief, but have almost no chance of success without a lawyer. Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND, is a national organization whose mission is to provide pro bono attorneys to immigrant children in deportation proceedings. KIND trains these lawyers, who often come from the corporate world, and then matches attorneys to children. Fewer than half the children in detention have attorneys when they appear in court. As of mid-September, some 12,800 immigrant children were being held in the custody of the Health and Human Services Department. The backlog that has developed in moving these children through the legal process is in part the result of potential sponsors being afraid to come forward for fear of being deported themselves, and the government's decision to prioritize the cases of children the Trump administration separated from their families at the border earlier this year. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Jennifer Podkol, policy director with KIND, Here she explains the role her organization plays in children's deportation cases and recent developments in the plight of immigrant youth.
Every person who the government decides that they want to try to remove from the country is put into removal proceedings or deportation proceedings. The burden is on the immigrant themselves to prove why they have a right to stay here. So they have to make their own case. So they have to have an understanding of U.S. immigration law to understand why they would have some sort of right to be here. Is it because they actually did have some sort of visa? Is it because they're asking for humanitarian protection and they want to make an application for humanitarian protection? And so it's really absurd to think that somebody, first of all, who doesn't speak English, let alone have an understanding of U.S. law, let alone have an understanding of U.S. immigration law, would be able to make a case for themselves in court without a lawyer. And it's even more absurd when you think about a young child.
So when they are represented by attorneys, how do these kids fare?
Most of the kids that we're representing, almost all of them, are applying for some sort of humanitarian protection, meaning, you know, they either suffered harm in their home country or they would suffer harm if they had to go back. And so that could be an application for asylum. That could be an application for special immigrant juvenile status, which is a special visa given to children who were abused or abandoned or neglected. And a judge has determined it's not in their best interest to go back to their country. There is something called a trafficking visa. So for someone who, for a child who's been the victim of human trafficking, they might be eligible for a special visa. And so these forms of relief are granted to children. And if they win their case, they're then eligible to apply for what's called, referred to as a green card, so that they could stay and live and work in the United States. You know, and I will tell you that when KIND is able to screen cases, you know, make the determination about who we think might qualify and who we think might be better off if they return to their home country, when we're able to screen the case and represent the child through the end of their case, we have an incredibly high success rate.
How high is it?
So if we're able to screen the case and represent the child through the end of their case, it's generally been over 90% of the cases we're able to be successful with.
Jen Podkol, I'm curious, you said these cases are hard to prove, and I imagine these kids come with little or no documentation. So how do you have such a high success rate?
I mean, it's amazing, you know, these attorneys who take the cases, particularly our pro bono attorneys, I mean, the amount of resources that they put into these cases is really amazing. And so it depends what kind of application the child is applying for. If they're applying for asylum, you know, there's a lot of research that goes into what's happening in the home country and trying to corroborate what the child said about what happened. Experts can provide testimony. So it depends on what kind of application the child is making.
What can you tell us about the expanded detention center for unaccompanied immigrant children in the desert at Tornillo in South Texas?
The government is running Tornillo as an emergency overflow shelter for kids, and it's the Office of Refugee Resettlement that's in charge of providing care and custody to unaccompanied children until they can find a sponsor in the U.S. who's willing to care for them while they go through their court process. What's happening in Tornillo is the government has implemented some policies that is making it harder for children to reunify with a sponsor. So kids are really backing up in this system, in this detention system. So ORR has had to resort to opening, you know, what they're referring to as this emergency facility, Tornillo. And it has over 3,000 beds in there, so over 3,000 children can be housed there. And they're holding children between the ages of 13 and 17, both boys and girls there. But because it's an emergency shelter, it is not licensed by the state, and ORR is making lower requirements for what services they're providing to children. So there's been limited access to legal counsel. There has been little to no educational services provided. So we're very worried about the government relying on, first of all, such a huge facility and the conditions of the detention. And it's not because we're seeing a huge influx of children arriving at our border. You know, in 2014, we saw a large number of children arrive, and it took the government by surprise, and so they relied on emergency shelters then. We're not in that situation now. We're not surprised by the number of arrivals of unaccompanied children right now. The government's own policies is frustrating the release of kids, so you have this inflated number of children in detention, and so the government's opening this kind of facility where they're housing children in tents. And to be quite frank, it looks like a refugee camp. You know, they're using tents in the middle of the desert. It looks like we're in a crisis right now where there's some sort of emergency on our border where we're being overrun. And we're absolutely not. You know, that's a false narrative.
That was Jennifer Podkol with Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND. Learn more about the plight of child immigrants being held in U.S. detention by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Low-wage workers engaged in the fight for increased pay and improved working conditions took to the streets between October 2nd and 4th. The strikes, protests, and rallies, organized by the Fight for 15 movement, took place in 7 states across the U.S., in Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Florida, Georgia, California, and Connecticut. In addition to calling for a living wage of $15 an hour, fast food, airport, hospital, and childcare workers were also demanding the right to unionize. On October 2nd in Detroit, 18 demonstrators were arrested at a Detroit McDonald's restaurant for what police said was disorderly conduct. One of those arrested was Rashida Tlaib, a Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. The Fight for 15 National Workers Alliance was founded in 2012 and backed by the Service Employees International Union, which has initiated other successful organizing drives, including the Justice for Janitors campaign. Fight for 15 is now engaged in campaigns to defeat anti-worker politicians across the U.S. in the 2018 midterm election. Your reporter spoke with Laura Huizar, staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project, who talks about the goals of these most recent Fight for 15 workers' actions and comments on Amazon.com's announcement that it will soon raise the company's minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Well, this latest action is one part of a series of actions that I think have been going on since 2012, when the campaign first started in November of 2012, and workers came out in New York City in support of both $15 as a minimum wage and a union. So this is a part of a long trajectory for the Fight for 15 and a movement that's been building across the country. And the demand continues to be the same. It's a $15 minimum wage and a good union to support workers in all areas of work that make jobs quality jobs.
Tell us a bit about maybe what happened around the country. I've read there were some arrests in Detroit, civil disobedience, but what kinds of things happened around the country in these 7 states? Maybe a few of the highlights you can summarize for us.
Yes, the workers came out on strike, for example, in Chicago at the McDonald's headquarters. There were some arrests there, protesters. I think in some cases, I think folks have said that up to 1,000 people came out in support of these actions. And I think it's a reflection of the momentum that the Fight for 15 has really built over the last 6 years at this point, almost 6 years. And it was workers in Chicago and Milwaukee, Detroit, San Jose, and cities across the country who came out. So it was a great show again of force.
With the wages, there's also a fight for unions, as you said. What are some of the current obstacles for workers who want to join a union or form a union of their own on the work site at places like these chain fast food restaurants and big box stores and other worksite venues where they currently don't have the opportunity for union representation?
You know, unfortunately, for years now, I think that corporations and actors on the right have put a lot of money into making it harder for workers to come together and form a union. And most recently this year, the U.S. Supreme Court made it very hard or much harder for public sector workers to come together as a union and collect dues through the Janus decision. But that was just the latest, I think, in a long history now of efforts to take away unions' power and make it harder for workers to come together. But I think there are still many ways in which workers can come together, assert that they want to be in a union, work with organizers who are incredibly committed and talented around the country to do that. Corporations will no doubt continue to spend a lot of money to scare workers, to put out bad messaging and bad arguments about what unions mean or could mean for workers. But I think that with wages having stagnated for so long and conditions having gotten so bad for so many workers, a lot more looking to unions as a solution and a way to build power as workers and demand what workers believe they need, and to assert those demands before corporations who do hold a lot of power.
Laura, I did want to ask you about your view on the recent announcement from Amazon Corporation that they will be increasing minimum wage of $15 as of November 1st for warehouse workers and some of their temporary seasonal employees. What's the importance of this announcement, if any?
It's an important first step for Amazon, I think, in showing that they do value their workers, and it's important for our large corporations and large employers to treat their workers fairly. But it is also just a first step. I think Amazon has come under scrutiny and has been criticized from a number of viewpoints, the way that they treat their temporary or staffing employees, the way that they treat their drivers, the way that they organize their warehouses and demand, fast-paced work with on-time scheduling that puts workers in truly difficult positions. And so wages will make a difference for many workers, but it's those other conditions that are also crucial to address, health and safety among them. And so we hope that Amazon will take the lead, not just in setting a good minimum wage, but showing what corporations can truly do to support their workers and create good jobs.
That was Laura Huizar, staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project. Learn more about the Fight for 15 Workers Alliance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRGU in Philadelphia, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KOPA in Pala, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.